So this week we're talking about Yaakov and Rachel, or also Leah?
Leah
as well. Okay, but my share this morning will be about Rachel. And did everyone have a chance to read through the Gemara? Yes? If not, I'll read it through quickly. Yes? Okay. So should I read it through?
Yeah.
Okay, fine. I'll read it through. Okay, so let's begin with this. The first source on the page is simply the biblical account of Yaakov's meeting with his future wife, Rachel. And it was a very, very romantic scene, right? Love at first sight, literally. As we know, Yaakov is insistent that this is the woman he wants to marry, and he makes the offer to Lavan. Evadcha sheva shanim b'Rachel bitcha haktana. I'm willing to work 7 years, and what's my salary? Simply the permission to marry your daughter Rachel. And he emphasizes bitcha haktana, knowing that she had an older sister, which, according to some protocol in those days at least, should have been married first, but that's the deal. And of course, we know that Lavan did not keep that deal. And what happened? He had a wedding, but it wasn't with Rachel, it was with Leah. Vayhi ba'erev, I'll read just the last psukim. Vayhi ba'erev, vayikach et Leah bito, vayaveh otai lav, vayavoi Leah, manages to go through the entire wedding and to consummate the marriage without realizing that it's not Rachel. Vayhi ba'boker v'hinehi Leah. In the morning, Yaakov realized, after the marriage, not only the wedding, but after the marriage had already been consummated, that it was actually Leah. He said to Lavan, what did you do? And this, is the beginning of a very, very, very tragic relationship between Yaakov and Leah as individuals, between Leah and her sister Rachel, who ultimately, of course, also married Yaakov, between their descendants, Bnei Leah and Bnei Yaakov, which reverberated throughout the centuries. Hundreds of years later, the Jewish people would split into two kingdoms, one led by Yehuda, by David's descendants who are descended from Leah, and the other led by the tribes that were descended from Rachel. And according to Yechezkel, the Navi Yechezkel, only in the Messianic era is that breach going to ultimately be put together. So, the Gemara Masechet Megillah, and it's really the Gemara that I want to focus on. I don't know to what extent this Gemara is attempting to tell us actual pshat, the actual filling in the blanks of the actual biblical narrative, and to what extent this should be viewed as an agadah, as some sort of a homiletic device. I'm not really concerned with that right now, because it's the Gemara's message that I'm interested in more than the, so to speak, historical reality here. Since not everyone got through it, I'll read through the Gemara quickly and we'll discuss it. Amar Rabbi Elazar, this is the Gemara Masechet Megillah, Daf Yud Gimel Amud Aleph, which continues on to the next page of Gimel Amud Bet. He quotes a pasuk, Lo Yigram Mitzadik Einav, God does not withdraw his eyes from the righteous people. And the Gemara makes the following, Rabbi Elazar, makes the following programmatic statement. Bishar Tzni'ut Shahaita Ba Birachel Zachta V'yatza Mimena Sha'ul ובשכר צניעות שהיה בה בשאול זכה ויצאת ממנו אסתר. Okay, the Gemara draws a link between three personalities who are all, each one descended from the other. Rachel, Shaul, king over a thousand years later, and actually less than a thousand years later, but many hundreds of years later, and from Shaul to Esther, also many hundreds of years later. The Gemara says, in reward for Rachel's tzniut, which will translate for now, as I believe they do in the English here, modesty. We'll talk in a few minutes about whether that's the best translation to determine what it means, but in reward for Rachel's tzniut, she was rewarded that one of her descendants was Shaul, the first king of Israel. Shaul, of course, comes from the tribe of Benjamin. Benjamin being one of the two tribes that came from Rachel, so therefore he is her descendant. And that was her reward for her tzniut. She was rewarded that she had this illustrious descendant, Shaul, the first king of Israel.
Which tzniut?
Yafet, the Gemara is going to say in a moment. Uvishar tzniut shahaya ba'o b'Shaul. Shaul also was exemplified by this characteristic of tzniut. Perhaps that's why he was the reward for Rachel. So he was also rewarded that he had a descendant, Esther Malka. Unlike Shaul being descended from Rachel, it's not explicit in the text that Esther is a descendant of Shaul. But we do know that Mordechai, who was Esther's cousin, very common mistake, says explicitly, Bat Dodo, cousin, but because there seems to have been a great age difference, people have this image of an uncle and a niece, that may have been more the emotional relationship, but they were actually first cousins, apparently. Yeah, very common mistake. I was just guilty of what they call entrapment. I knew somebody was going to say cousin, that's why I did that. A niece, that's why I did that.
I am so glad that I spoke to my
Thank you. But in any case, Mordechai, who is a cousin of Esther, was descended from Kish, and Kish was Shaul's father, so there seems to be some at least familiar relationship. But the Gemara assumes that, and the commentaries try to figure out exactly how this works, but that Esther was also a descendant of Shaul. Okay, so Rachel was exemplified by Tzniut, and as a reward, she had among her descendants Shaul HaMelech, who himself was exhibited the character of Tzniut, and as a result was rewarded that one of his illustrious descendants was Esther. And now the Gemara asks the question that you asked, Umay Tzniut Haita Baba Rachel, what is the Tzniut for which she was rewarded? Dichtiv, Vayaged Yaakov de Rachel ki achi aviyahu. It said in the Psukim, that we didn't read these out loud, but it says in those Psukim, maybe we should read that Pasuk inside, it's on the second line of the Psukim on the first page. Right, he comes, let's read from the very beginning of it. Vayhi kasher ra'a Yaakov et Rachel bat Lavan achi imo, v'etzon lachan Lavan achi imo, v'yigash Yaakov v'yagel d'evan. He sees her, he's overwhelmed with emotion, he, in a some sort of superhuman way, manages to move this heavy rock. V'yishak Yaakov v'Rachel, he approaches her, he kisses her, he cries. V'yaged Yaakov v'Rachel, and she apparently was somewhat overwhelmed by this stranger who came and did all these things and starts kissing her and crying on her, etc. And then he then explains, Vayaged Yaakov l'Rachel ki achi aviyahu, which literally would be translated as he is her father's brother, but more generally her father's relative. And then it says more specifically, v'chi ben Rifkahu. Okay, they were actually also first cousins, right? Yaakov's mother Rifka was the sister of Rifka's father Lavan, right? So they're first cousins, and he calls him ben. He calls him Achi Aviyah, her father's brother, but actually he's not her brother, he's her father's nephew. So the Gemara is a little bit bothered by that expression. V'chi Achi Aviyahu, v'halo ben Achot Aviyahu. He's not really her father's brother, he's her father's nephew. Now as I just explained, the word Ach can also be used as relative, but some of the commentators discussed the fact that he already, once the Pasuk, if it had just said he told her Achi Aviyahu, he's her father's relative, then we could translate it as relative. But it specifies the exact relationship. That he's Ben Rifkahu. That he's the son of Rifkahu, who's her father's sister. So what does it mean that he was her father's brother? That seems at that point superfluous and inaccurate. So the Gemara here interprets that expression metaphorically. Meaning, it interprets the expression Achi Aviyah, he's her father's brother, not in the literal sense, but rather, Ela Amala, here's what happened according to, this is the how the Gemara fills in the blanks of that difficult expression. Amarla, he said to her, Min Sivali, will you marry me? Amra Layin, she said, yes, I will marry you. Miu, but we have a problem. Abba Rama'ahu, my father is a trickster. How do they translate it here? A swindler, right? My father's a dishonest fellow, and I know he's not going to let us get away with this. I have an older sister, and she already knew what was going to happen. So, in other words, he asked her to marry him, and she said, in principle, yes, I would like to marry you, but I'm telling you, it's not going to be so simple. It's not going to work out. Below yachalple, you're not going to be able to pull this off. That's what she said to him. Amar la, and why not? Because he's a swindler. Ramahu. Amarla achiv ana b'ramaut. I'm his brother. I'm his equal. I can be just as conniving as your father can. Don't worry about it. I'll take care of it. Amrale, she then asked him, according to this midrashic account, Umishari litzadike lisiguye b'ramayuta? Is it okay? My father's a dishonest person. My father's a no good whatever. But you're a righteous person. That's why I want to marry you. Is it appropriate for you to engage in deception? Amar Layin, he said, yes, it is. And it quotes the pasuk, "Im navar tivavi mekish titapal." It's inappropriate to use dishonest methods when dealing with upstanding people. But if someone's trying to cheat you, you can outsmart him and beat him at his own game. So don't worry about it. He says to her, "We're going to get married, and I'm not concerned with your father's tricks. I'm just as sneaky as him, and I'll outsmart your father. Don't worry about it." Amar Lev, then he asked her, "Umay Ramu Yusei?" She hadn't told him yet what the specific concern was. Why are you afraid that your father is going to do something? Amar Lev, "Itli achta de kshisha minai." I have a sister who's older than me. "Velo mintziv li mikama." She's still single, and he's not going to marry me off before he marries her off. So what did Yaakov do? He said, "No problem. Masar la simanim." He said, "This is an easy one to solve," and he gave her secret codes. Doesn't tell us what the codes were, but they arranged certain signals between them so that if her father would do what she already anticipated he would do and what he eventually did do, which is to try to slip in Leah under the guise of Rachel, there would be some kind of secret code, some kind of, it doesn't tell us what the code was, but Yaakov would be able to determine that this is not in fact Leah. And therefore Yaakov said, "See, I'm smarter than your father. Problem solved." And then he goes and asks for her hand in marriage and agrees to the 7 years, etc. Time passes. Himatia Lelia, 7 years later, it's now time for the wedding night. Everything's going as planned. Amra, and this is the tzniut. We'll talk in a moment about why that word is used. But this is the tzniut, this is the climax of the Gemara. Rachel then said to herself, "Wait a second. Everything's going as planned, but something terrible is about to happen. Hashta michsafa achatai. My sister is now going to be humiliated. What's going to happen? The whole village is coming to this grand wedding of the wealthy Lavan's eldest, not eldest, youngest daughter, so to speak. And right there in front of everybody, somehow it's going to be revealed, right? Yaakov's going to realize that it's not Rachel. It's going to be a whole commotion and the whole wedding's going to be ruined. And who's going to be humiliated? My poor sister Leah, who, after all, is innocent. It's not her fault. Masartinhu Niala. And so she went to Leah and she said, "Listen, I have this, Yaakov knew that this was going to happen, or I knew this was going to happen. We have this secret code," and she told Leah whatever the signals were so that Leah could impersonate Rachel and get away with it, and that's what happened. What? It doesn't say, but apparently, and perhaps this is why it doesn't go into any more detail, whatever the signals were, assumedly, Yaakov didn't find out until after he had consummated the marriage also. Okay? So on the one hand, she was concerned about Leah being humiliated publicly, so assumedly something was supposed to happen under the chuppah. But as you see in the next line in the Gemara, "V'hainu dichtiv," and this is how the Gemara explains a different pasuk, which is also difficult. But what does it say in the next pasuk? "V'hi v'boker v'hine hi Leah," which literally means, "And it was in the morning that she was Leah." Michlal da'ad hashtalav Leah. What does that mean? In the morning she was Leah? And who was she the night before? It should have said, "In the morning Yaakov realized that she was Leah," but that's not what it said. It says, "In the morning she was Leah." Ela mitoch simanim shemisaral Rachel Leah lo hava yada ad hashta. She was able to successfully impersonate Rachel until the morning. In the morning, when the sun came up and he was able to see her face, he was able to, you know, then the game was up. So what I'm saying is, I think there's a hint here that whatever the signals were, on the one hand, there was Rachel seems to have been concerned that something was going to happen at the wedding itself. But it also seems, and they don't go into explicit detail, but it seems that in the bedroom at night as well, Leah was able to continue impersonating Rachel. In other words, the signals must have included some intimate things between them as well. Only in the morning, v'hinehi Leah. Only in the morning was she no longer able to impersonate Rachel and be Leah. Yes?
It just occurred to me that it certainly displayed tzniut, whatever that means.
I'm not sure it certainly displayed tzniut. That's exactly what I want to talk about.
But the fact that Leah agreed to do this deception, she could have said, "Oh, Rachel, I know how much you're in love with this guy. I'm really, thank you for the offer." But she agreed to it.
Right.
So what does it say about her then?
I don't know. I do know that Yaakov was very upset. But let's hold that thought for a moment, okay? I, Actually, I want to focus more on Rachel than on Leah, but I'm going to pick up on that question in a moment. Let's just finish the Gemara first, okay? Okay, lefikach, in reward for this great act of self-sacrifice, which the Gemara called sniut, zachta, she merited v'yatza mimena sha'ul. Now, let's just finish the Gemara. Okay, so she was rewarded with sha'ul. Now, the Gemara said that sha'ul was also exhibited sniut and was rewarded with Esther. So the Gemara continues on the next page. Umat tzniut haitah b'sha'ul. And what was his tzniut? What was his modesty? Dichtiv, it says, ve'etvar hamlucha lo higid lo asher amar Shmuel. If you recall the situation when Sha'ul became anointed king, there was no elections and he hadn't submitted an application to become king. Not at all. The people had come to the prophet Shmuel and had demanded a king. Shmuel himself didn't want a king. They had a whole discussion. God told Shmuel he's going to have to be a king, and I'll tell you who it's going to be. And then God had told Shmuel that on a certain day, I'm going to arrange for a person to come to you, and he's the one I have chosen. And God arranged for Shaul, who lived in a different city than Shmuel, both in the same tribe, in the tribe of Benjamin, but in a different city. A whole story happened. His father's donkeys escaped, and his father sent Shaul running around looking for the donkeys. He couldn't find the donkeys. Finally, someone suggested, go ask Shmuel the Navi, maybe he can help you find the donkeys. And Hashem told Shmuel, this is the one. Shaul shows up looking for the donkeys. Shmuel tells him, before he asks, Shmuel tells him, don't worry, your donkeys have been found, but I have to tell you something else, actually. Come with me. And he pours a little oil on his head and says, you've just become king of Israel. Okay? That was a bit of a shock for Shaul. Then and he gave him all sorts of signals how he could know. And then it says that when Shaul came home, he met a relative of his who asked him, where have you been? And he says, well, I was looking for the donkeys. But he didn't say, oh, and by the way, I was about to become king. Meaning, he had been anointed king. It had not yet been publicly announced. But he knew already that he was going to become the king and it was going to be shortly announced. And he didn't say. When it's known, it'll be known. That was considered tzniut. Okay, so Rachel, who exhibited tzniut, was rewarded with a great-great-great-great-grandson who was also tzanua, who exhibited tzniut. And therefore, he also merited zacha b'yatzat mimeno Esther. Okay, the rest of the Gemara just wraps up. I think that's enough for our purposes. In my opinion, there are two questions in this Gemara. The first question is a version of the question that you asked. Let's go back to Rachel, right? Undoubtedly, and again, let's take this Gemara at face value. Again, I'm not concerned right now with the question of to what extent this Gemara is trying to actually fill in the lines of the biblical narrative and explain to us what actually happened. Perhaps that is. Perhaps the Gemara is simply using this whole thing as a homiletic frame to make a point. Either way, let's look at the story the way the Gemara tells it and ask, on the one hand, for Rachel to do that showed a tremendous amount of sacrifice. There's no question about it. You're asking, but Leah should have said, you know, thank you, but no thank you. I have a different question. Why was it the right thing for Rachel herself to do? Undoubtedly, it displayed tremendous self-sacrifice. But first of all, look what it caused. She knew, okay, it will save her sister from some momentary embarrassment and condemn her sister to a life of being an unwanted wife. And furthermore, while this might have been a very, very admirable act of kindness and generosity towards her sister, what about Yaakov?
We know that she loves him, except the Gemara tells us.
Okay.
We never know that she actually says she'll marry him, except that.
That is an interesting. That is an interesting point.
We never hear of 7 years of cavorting or playing in the field.
Okay, that's a very good point. It does not. It says that Yaakov loved Rachel. It does not say that Rachel loved Yaakov. By the way, just one moment. By the way, trivia question. There's only one case that I'm aware of in the entire Tanakh where it says that a woman loved a man and not the other way around. And that's Michal, the daughter of Shaul. It says that she loved David. But whether or not she loved Yaakov, that's an interesting question. But whether or not she loved Yaakov doesn't change the fact that she became party to her father's deception. Yaakov becomes a victim, right? And again, we're reading here the Gemara's version of the story. And the Gemara's version of the story, she readily wanted to marry him. But one way or another, the Gemara is saying she's being rewarded for this great act, which again, undoubtedly involves great sacrifice, but doesn't seem to me necessarily to be something admirable or even something correct. Meaning she turns at the, maybe Leah, and certainly, in other words, whether Leah herself is a perpetrator or a victim is an interesting question. In a way, Yaakov's a victim. And Rachel becomes party to that. Right? So that's question number one I have. Yes?
I think we're forgetting the fact that in those days, women had no choice. In these matters, fathers decided who was going to marry whom. And it may be that these sisters attempted to deal with what was a reality for them, that they had no choice. And in essence, they decided to make the best of it. And if Yaakov wasn't happy with Leah, since in those days those men could have many wives, he would have an opportunity to find somebody else.
Which he did.
Right. So, you know, we're looking at this from where we are today. But I think, you know, if there is a strong possibility, the girls didn't have any choice. Daddy says such and such and such. That's it.
There's no question that there's a lot of truth to your statement. However, the way the Gemara tells the story, Rachel actually did take initiative, actually did manage to get to a point where she could have outsmarted her father, ultimately chose not to, and is being rewarded for it. So, in the end, she actually was in control, according to this, and voluntarily gave up that control, so to speak.
We don't know where she was during the ceremony.
Right. Is she crying her eyes out? Is she standing there in a bridesmaid's dress, smiling? All good questions. Yes.
The problem on that a little bit is that she was also taking a chance that Yaakov would get so angry with her that he would want to marry her.
Oh, I think that's for sure. I think it's for sure that the Gemara is, or even if he's not angry with her,
then the father would agree with her.
Right. I think it's clear that the Gemara is. That according to this narrative, at the moment she gives Leah the signs, she is, in her mind, giving up on, at least potentially giving up on the possibility of ever marrying Yaakov. Not that she's agreeing to share Yaakov with Leah, that as far as she knows, she's losing him completely. Or at least she may be losing him. That's clear. Okay? Okay, so question number one is...
That could be another.
I'm sorry?
That could be another possibility. That Rachel gave the signs and she was... convinced that Jacob would find out. He loves her so much. How come he doesn't find out?
What do you mean? They had a secret code and she gave all the secret codes.
Never mind. Yeah. Had a secret code. In her mind, she would have found out.
Then you're suggesting that, but then why would she do it in the first place? Then in the end, she's still going to get Leah embarrassed then. The whole point here is that she says, I have to protect Leah from embarrassment, and she's rewarded for it afterwards. To me, it doesn't sound like that's the intention of Gemara. Yes? Okay, right. So I want to put that first question on the side for everyone to come back to it. Why, in fact, is Rachel being praised and rewarded for this? But let's also discuss this. Let's, for the moment, assume that it was, for some reason that we have yet to figure out, the right thing for her to do. Why is this being described as tzniut? That's the question I want to first address, and with that, perhaps go back to that. Now, the word tzniut, first of all, is a word that has many, many connotations, and that today is one of the buzzwords in today's Orthodox community, and not Orthodox community, today's Jewish discourse. Today, when the word is used, it's generally associated with something, right, with clothing, particularly women's clothing, or more generally with sexual morality and interaction between men and women and things of that nature. Things that seem to have nothing to do with this story, unless we perhaps think through the fact that the signs seem to have included something intimate that was to happen between them in the bedroom, which maybe has something to do with tzniut, but if Rachel then enables Yaakov to consummate a marriage with a woman who he doesn't realize is consummate, that doesn't exactly sound like tzniut. Right? Now, it could be, again, if we grant that for some reason that we have yet to explain it was the right thing to do, then it could be that the message is that, look, extraordinary circumstances call for extraordinary methods, and even though certain things are generally highly inappropriate, there are times that they're... So then what you have to say is that which would normally be the value of tzniut needs to be, you know, temporarily suspended in the height of a greater value. And you could praise her for that, but why would you describe that as tzniut? You could describe it as her sacrifice. You could describe it as her selfishness. Lots of selflessness. You could describe it as all sorts of things. To describe that as tzniut seems highly out of whack. Now, tzniut is often translated into English as modesty. And the, at least the English word modesty had its other connotations as well. For example, if we look at what Shaul is praised for later, right, which is also called Tzniut in the Gemara, right, that he, you know, knew he was going to be the king, but didn't go around bragging about it, and in fact concealed it, and, you know, that we would call modest. Again, in Hebrew, I might use the word anava, your term, more than Tzniut, but to the extent that modesty is a good translation, I can understand why that, perhaps.
Not
revealing something, right. But Rachel, that doesn't seem to fit what she did either. By the way, the word tzniut, those who are familiar with modern Hebrew might be able to know what the Hebrew root tsadi nun ayin means, literally.
Hidden.
Hidden, right? So perhaps the most literal, right, keeping something like when you put something away, it's lahatsniya, right? Or even in Aramaic, by the way. In Aramaic, when one does something publicly, it's called bifarhesia, and the opposite of that is called bitzina, which is the form of the same root. So perhaps a more literal translation of tzniut might be not modesty, but privacy. And again, that's something that perhaps could describe what Shaul did. But what Rachel did seems to be the opposite of privacy. She revealed a secret. Now again, let's grant for a moment that it was the right thing to do. Sometimes you can't keep things. Sometimes secrets need to be revealed. Sometimes the general value of not revealing private information sometimes has to be superseded by something else, perhaps. But then don't say that she's rewarded for her tzniut. Say she's rewarded for understanding that sometimes something has to supersede tzniut. There's something that seems very, very strange about the Gemara's. Again, besides the question of why it was the right thing in the first place, characterizing it as tzniut seems very, very out of whack. So what I'd like to do now is to try to see if we can understand a little more what that word tzniut means in perhaps a broader way. And with that, then go back and try to see if we can answer the first question. If you look at the source that's not translated there, I put on the page here two other sources that have nothing to do with our topic, except that they both use the word tzniut, or a form thereof. The first is a fairly well-known pasuk in the Navi Micha, which says the following. I see some of it got cut off on the page. Higid lecha adam matov u'ma Hashem doresh mimcha. The prophet Micha says, this is what is good, and this is what God wants from you, O man. Ki'im, the following things, and it lists three things that God wants from him. Ki'im asot mishpat v'ahavat chesed. Right, to do justice and to love kindness. Right, it says you're supposed to. Some of the commentators point out you're supposed to do justice, but you're supposed to love kindness. Kindness is, you know, even more than right, a person is supposed to be chasing that, so to speak. V'hatznei lechet im Elokecha, and one should walk with tzniut with your God. Now, that doesn't tell me what the word means, and therefore I didn't translate it. Here in the English they write, walk humbly. Right, so they're assuming, interesting, walk humbly, not walk modestly. Okay, they're assuming they're, again, fitting, that would fit again with the description of Shaul. But even if that's not what the word means, and we don't know what the word means, here it tells us that this pasuk puts tzniut in the same grouping, in this mishpat and chesed, justice and kindness. Those are things that are not identical, but we sort of understand that they're in a similar category, right? First, treat other people justly. Don't steal from people. Don't, you know, take advantage of people, etc. And on top of that, be kind to people. Tzniut is somehow put into that category. I'm not sure exactly what it means here, but it doesn't seem to fit with modesty or humility. And certainly not with things like skirt lengths. That certainly seems totally out of... What does that have to do with mishpat and tzedakah? Mishpat and chesed, I'm sorry. But the last source is even more startling, in my opinion. The last source, I gave you a Gemara that has nothing to do with anything we're talking about. It's a halachic discussion having to do with the laws of sha'adnez. Okay, we know that you're not allowed to wear clothing that has wool and linen woven together. There's certain clothing that you're not allowed to wear. Let's just read this, and you'll see why we're doing it in a minute. Mochrei ksut. One of the laws of sha'anez is that one is prohibited from wearing clothing that's made from wool and linen together, but only if one is wearing it for the purpose in which one normally wears clothing. Why does one wear clothing? To cover our bodies, either for tzniut, right, because we don't want to walk around naked, and perhaps to protect ourselves from the elements, right, in the winter to keep us warm, in the summer to protect from the sun, from the rain, etc. But if you're wearing an article of clothing for a completely different reason, that would be okay. What would be such an example? Mochrei ksut. People who sell clothing. We were talking earlier about modeling, right? So people used to... clothing merchants sometimes would go into the marketplace, and in order to sell their wares, they would bottle them. They would wear the clothing. You know, literally, what's the old expression? I'll sell you the shirt off my back, right? Right? They would walk around with, assuming they're not, you know, let's say a coat. You know, who wants to buy the coat? So a person who is selling to non-Jews, let's say, right, in a place where the non-Jews are allowed to buy chatnez, and chatnez is not prohibited. You're allowed to get benefit from chatnez. It's not a surbana. So if I'm selling clothing that's made of chatnez in a marketplace that's only not where the customers are all non-Jews, and if there's no problem selling to them, and I want to wear the garment, assumedly I'm wearing something underneath it because I'm going to take it off afterwards, so I don't need it just to be dressed, and assumedly maybe I'm even uncomfortable, maybe it's hot, I'm wearing it, I'm really not getting any of the general benefit one normally gets out of wearing clothing. So that is therefore permissible according to this Gemara. Mochrei ksut mochrin kedarkan. Uvilvad shelo yitkaven b'chamam itnei chamah uvigshamim itnei gshamim. Provided that it's actually like if it happens to be raining and we have to wear a raincoat, and they say, oh, you know, on the one hand, I sort of hope I get a customer because I'd like to make money, but you know what? I'm kind of happy if I don't get a customer because I'm. Then it shows that you're actually also getting benefit from wearing. Then it would not be allowed. But assuming that's not the case, you're not having any intention to, you know, be protected from the sun or the rain or anything else, then it's okay. Why am I discussing this with you right now? The Gemara then continues. The Brice, actually. Then continues. That's the law. Technically speaking, it's permissible. However, the Brice then says, V'hatsnu'in mafshilin b'makel l'achorehen. The Brice mentions a group of people who the Brice calls tsnu'in, which is the same word. We would translate that as modest people or something like that. What do? Even though it is permissible for them, right? They apparently, some of these people called snuin worked in this field. They were mochrei ksut, they sold clothing. And even though they knew that it was permissible, they would be doing nothing wrong by wearing the... Still, they didn't do that. Instead, they put some kind of a hanger or something on their backs and they walked around not actually wearing it, on a stick or something, not to do something that is close to an isur, even though it's not. Okay, so the Gemara is telling us here that it's permissible, but there are these people that are, and it seems that they're praised for this, you know, sort of extra careful or whatever. What would we call people like that? People who go beyond the letter of the law, people who are particularly careful. Okay, we would call them machmirim, perhaps, right? People who are stricter, take upon themselves stringencies. We call them Hasidim, perhaps, right, in the original meaning of the term, right?
Zealous.
People are maybe even zealous, right? I don't think we would call them tsnuim. We wouldn't call them people who are modest. Or again, what I'm trying to show you is that the word tsniut seems to be used in all kinds of contexts that are beyond what we normally associate with that term. Making us go back and ask again, okay, so what does the Gemara mean when it calls Rachel's act an act of tsniut? Okay, so let's put the data together and see what we come up with. The word tsniut we have in which context now? We have it in the context of clothing and sexual morality in general. We have it in the context of humility. We have it in the context of Rachel's action, which for the moment we're going to grant was considered a positive thing, of Shaul's lack of boastfulness. We have it placed together in Micha with Mishpat and Chesed. And we have this idea that people who are extremely pious, extremely religious, extremely stringent in their interpretation of mitzvot are also called tsnuim. And we have the fact that the word literally means privacy or secrecy. So can we come up with some definition that sort of encompasses all of those things? Yes?
Perhaps all of them are responding to a higher meaning of the word in that they're tapped into whatever prophecy like Rachel, knowing that having children and building up Israel in the future is very, very important, and women are built up through their children, and she is acting in a snuah, in a way that raises up Leah. And whether Yaakov's a victim or not, he's needed in order to carry on the future generation.
And she's seeing more far-reaching vision, looking beyond the here and now, beyond my immediate needs, beyond anyone's immediate needs, beyond... Okay, so yeah.
I think it's just more based on just thinking about other people's feelings.
Okay.
Rachel projecting other people's feelings. I'm trying to wear clothes, you don't want other people to be mixed up and accidentally think that maybe it's okay to wear those clothes.
Okay.
Like, you're thinking of others.
Okay. Thinking of others, or at least not thinking of yourself.
Right, putting others...
Right? It could also be maybe thinking of God, meaning one possibility might be that the people don't want anyone to be confused by it, or it also could be just that it's a matter of religious piety. In other words, I don't want to go anywhere near something that might be prohibited, even if it's technically permissible in this case. And those two could work together also pretty nicely, yeah?
I was thinking that if he has to choose burning your own...
Okay. Okay, excellent. Yeah?
But the thing with Shaul is he was, at least at that point, he was actually a very modest man, because when the announcement was made public, he almost ran away.
Yeah, we're going to talk about that in a moment.
Find him.
Right? Correct. We'll talk about that in a moment. Exactly. Okay? All right, so I think we're getting to something here, okay? Maybe I'll put it this way, okay? Tzniut, which again literally means privacy, person who's defined as tsanua perhaps as someone who's looking inward and not outward. Person who looks at themselves, himself or herself, not through the eyes of others, and therefore isn't interested in showing off, isn't interested in protecting any sort of image or anything like that. Only themselves in front of God. And that enables a person, first of all, to be humble, and standing in front of God, a person who sees themselves standing in front of God is going to be humbled by that experience. It enables a person to not want to show off, to lead a private and humble existence. And it leads to holiness. And it leads to self-sacrifice. It leads to a person also being willing to give up their own needs for the sake of some higher value and for the sake of the future. Right? I think everything we're saying here kind of comes together. Okay, so let's look at it in that light. If we look at it in that light, then what Rachel did can certainly be called tzniut. Even if in this case it involved doing something which ordinarily wouldn't be called tzanua, revealing private things and, you know. But let's go back to that first question. Why is she being rewarded for this? I'm a bit nervous about what I'm about to say. Because I'm gonna suggest something very unconventional that I haven't seen in any of the sources explicitly, although I put on the page the source I found that's closest to this. And I hope that what I'm saying is not... heretical would be too strong of a word anyway, but not irreverent. Okay. I'm not 100% sure that this Gemara is praising Rachel's action unqualifiedly. I'm not sure. Let's take a look here. I wrote Ein Yaakov. It's actually there was a typo. It's actually the Iyun Yaakov, which is a commentary on the book Ein Yaakov, which itself brings down, it's a collection of the Agadic sections of the Talmud. So, commenting on this Gemara, he writes, I apologize that it's not translated in English, but I'll just. Umat tzniut hayta b'Rachel b'chulei simanim shemasar la. V'nireh, he says, the hainu tzniuta. Why is that called tzniut? Again, he's dealing with our original question. I'm not giving a very broad answer like I did. He's dealing with something a little bit more specific. Tzniut is privacy, is keeping things hidden. So why is that called tzniut? She'ilim malei lo hayta tznua. V'hayta umeret la'aviha shehi chafetz bo v'yesh lo asimanim imo lo haya aviha usera ramaut. Rak machmat sniut lo gil talavia. Now, he's giving an alternate answer to our original question. If we take sniut as not revealing something, so why is it sniut that she revealed to her sister? So he's saying no. When she, at the last moment, revealed it to her sister, that wasn't sniut. That was perhaps an unavoidable breach of sniut. or a breach of tzniut. Let's not say unavoidable for a moment. But the tzniut was that she didn't say, she could have said something to her father 7 years earlier. She could have gone to her father and said, look, I want to marry him. I don't think you're going to get away with this, Dad, because we have signals. We have secret codes. It's not going to work. And he said, had she done that, Lavan would have realized that he can't get away with it. And in fact, he wouldn't have tried.
No.
Now, what is that? What question does that lead to? Okay, so that's what he's saying. He's answering the question of tzniut and saying that tzniut was not what she did at the last moment by giving it to Rachel. The tzniut was that for 7 years she kept her mouth shut and didn't say anything to her father. And he says, had she said something to her father, it would have worked. In other words, Yaakov was right when he said, Achiv ana b'ramaut, we can outsmart your father. And had Rachel just went over to Lavan and said, don't try anything, it's not going to work, Lavan would have realized that he had been outsmarted. After all, it will humiliate him too. He wouldn't have tried. In which case, what would have happened? She would have married Yaakov. So what question does that lead to? Why is she being rewarded for it then? And I'm questioning whether in fact, what does the Gemara say? The Gemara says, "Bischar tzniut." By the way, the word sachar, which we sometimes translate as reward, doesn't always mean reward. It also can mean result. I'm not suggesting here that the Gemara is
consequence.
A consequence, perhaps, yes. I want to suggest that here's the potentially irreverent suggestion. Okay? And I'm wondering if the Ilan Yaakov is hinting to this too. I wonder if the Gemara is saying the following. On the one hand, one has to admire Rachel's great act of self-sacrifice, her willingness to give everything up for the sake of her sister, on the one hand. On the other hand, perhaps it was misguided. Sometimes, it's not the right thing. She felt, how can I be selfish and take this for myself? But by trying to be unselfish, what happened? Again, she got Leah into a unhappy marriage. She got Yaakov. She deceived Yaakov and did something perhaps immoral. And potentially, what would have happened? We can only speculate what would have happened. Apparently, there was a divine plan. We don't want to say, I don't think that Yaakov shouldn't have married Leah. But perhaps, apparently it was the divine plan that Yaakov had to marry both of them. But perhaps he could have married Rachel first and things could have developed differently and he would have wound up marrying Leah under different circumstances and perhaps that would have resulted in a different relationship, less resentment. Who knows? All I'm suggesting is perhaps what the Gemara is saying is, on the one hand, what Rachel did is admirable for its self-sacrifice and therefore it demonstrates tzniut in that sense we just mentioned, tzniut of a person who looks at themselves in front of God and sees only that and puts everything else aside. But it was tzniut that was a little bit out of place. And that was used in the wrong way. And perhaps she needed to understand that there are times when you have to suppress that instinct and say, at this case I'm going to do what's good for myself, not because I want it for myself, but because it's the right thing to do under these circumstances. And not automatically give something up. Just one moment. Just let's carry this through for a moment and see if that makes any sense. Bischar tzniut. Shaita babi Rachel zachta v'yatza mimenu sha'ul. What was her reward? What was the result? Sha'ul. And sha'ul is a person who is exceedingly tzanua. Right? And the Gemara points to an example. And when he knew he was the king, he didn't tell anybody else. But the Gemara could have given other examples. At that point, perhaps, what would have been gained by telling his relative that I'm going to be the king? Just showing off. It'll become clear sooner or later. But as you mentioned, what happened a short time later when there was a public inauguration ceremony? It's almost comical, the Psukim in the book of Shmuel. Right? The entire nation, assumedly representatives of the entire nation, gathered in Mitzpah for this ceremony where they're going to announce the new king. Okay, and even though Shmuel and Shaul both knew who it was, Shmuel wanted to demonstrate that this was not his personal choice, but it was from God, so he conducted a lottery. Right? But the idea that it's going to be determined by God. And of course, the lottery actually, first, which Shevet is it from? And it came to Binyamin. And then which clan within the Shevet and which family? And down. And we all, both, he knew who was going to come to. And when they finally came to the point that he announced it, that, finally came down, they pulled out the name Shaul ben Kish. Ladies and gentlemen, this is the climactic moment. Right? Everyone's been waiting for it. I now introduce to you, he pulls out of the hat, right? The first king of Israel. Ladies and gentlemen, and there's only one person in the crowd who knows what the name is supposed to be, right? That's Shaul himself. And Shmuel. Shaul ben Kish. Vayivakshuhu velo nimtza. They looked for him, and he's not there. This is what my children call fadicha, right? Let's try that again. Shaul ben Kish. Vayishalu od Hashem. They said, Shmuel goes to God. Something's not working out here. Where is he? Vayomer Hashem. And he needed God to tell Shmuel. Hinehu nechba el hakelim. He's hiding behind something. At his own inauguration, he was in hiding. Now, at this point, we have to ask already, is this admirable humility? Or is this already something else? The man is about to become Melech Yisrael. And he's going to have to lead a nation. Is this the time to display such... And perhaps you'll say, okay, no, it is. It is. You know, he wanted to show the people, maybe this was a calculated move, he wanted to start his administration that way by showing that he's not in this for glory, and perhaps... But Shaul's kingdom didn't last for very long. Even though, if you study the Psukim, this is for another shiur at another time, Shaul, if you read the book of Shmuel carefully, it looks like Shaul was a complete failure. If you read between the lines, it turns out he was an incredibly successful king, an incredibly righteous man, but not just a righteous man, and a really successful king who accomplished a tremendous amount. Okay, that's a separate, I actually did give a course on that here in Matan, actually, and perhaps at some future point. Shaul was a very successful king, but ultimately a failure. Meaning, he accomplished a lot, but he ultimately failed. His failure comes at two points. One, the first time, was when he had been told prior to a battle with the Plishtim, he had been told that he has to get all the people together and bring a korban. And he was told to wait for Shmuel to come before offering the Korban. And he waited for a week, and the people were getting restless, and it's a test of leadership, because people started to leave, and he panicked, and he brought the Korban early. And then Shmuel showed up and said, what did you do? You're supposed to be showing leadership here. But then, the more direct cause was when it came time for the Battle of Amalek, of course, where he didn't, and that's also worthy of an entire discussion. Which I also spoke about earlier in the year of Matan. Without going into that whole discussion and how we deal with this very difficult concept of wiping out a nation, all that, let's just, for the purpose of this, assume that what the Navi says, it was the right thing for him to do. And he almost did it. I'm sorry?
How come we never hear about Laban's wife, the mother of Rachel and Leah, her...
There's a lot of women in Tanakh. There's a lot of women in Tanakh we never hear about.
I know, but she didn't direct her daughters. I mean,
it's a great question.
Did you see the strife that was going on?
Maybe the answer is that she was helpless.
Yeah.
As we said earlier, the women generally didn't have any control. Or maybe the answer is that she was, a fitting match for her husband, and she was then on a completely. I don't know. It's fascinating to speculate.
In both these cases, it's
right. So this is what I want to get to. When Shmuel finally confronted him after the sin with Amalek, Shmuel said something very important to him. He said, I had the place marked in my Tanakh, and then I pulled the place mark out by mistake. Here it is. It seems that Shaul didn't even realize. He had done most of what he was supposed to do. He wiped out an entire nation. He left one man and some of the animals alive. He was supposed to wipe out all the animals. And the Navi actually focuses on the animals. He was supposed to wipe out all the animals, which means destroy all the property, not take any benefit from Amalek. And they kept, it says, Meitav Hatzon, the best of the animals. When Shmuel then came, Shaul then sees Shmuel coming, and completely oblivious to the fact that he has done something wrong, he proudly says to Shmuel, unlike the last time when Shmuel came to him and he had messed up with the Korban, he says to him, Baruch atah Hashem, hakimoti et dvar Hashem. I have fulfilled God's word. And Shmuel said to him, Ume kol hatzon hazeh bi'oznai? Oh, really? I hear some sheep. Right. Have you all been on that? If you read the way it's written with the ta'amim, it's Ume kol hatzon hazeh bi'oznai. Right? What is that exactly? Right? The kol habakar. And he says, oh, yeah, that me'amaleki havim. We brought them back from Amalekim, from the Amaleki. God had told him not to. Asher chamal ha'am al meitav atzon dabakar leman zvoach la'Hashem elokecha. Betayoterech haramti. Real, it's true, I did get rid of most of them, but the people thought that would be good to take this back and bring that. So the people said to do it, and I follow what the people wanted.
They want to bring it for a
korban. And Shmuel then says to Shaul the following. Later on he tells him, God doesn't want your sacrifices, he wants you to listen to him. That's also an important lesson. But before that he says, and this I think is a key point. He says, you told me it's what the people wanted. Vayomer Shmuel, Haloim katon ata be'einecha. Maybe you are small in your own eyes. Rosh shivtei Yisrael ata. You're the king of Israel. And you're the king. You're not supposed to be doing what the people want. You're supposed to be leading the people. We call this today ministerial responsibility or something like that. But look at how he says it to him. Haloim katon ata be'inecha. In other words, what ultimately brought Shaul down, according to what Shmuel himself said to him, was excessive humility. Shaul showed this humility where, you know, he doesn't want to go walk around telling everyone he's the king. He meets his relative in the beginning, and the Gemara praises him for that, right? He doesn't tell him he's the king. Okay, very nice. At his own inauguration, he doesn't jump up and say, I'm the new king. We say, okay, it's a little strange, but maybe it's right. But when push came to shove, he failed as the king because of his... because he didn't view himself as worthy. Who am I to... all the people want this. And what does Shmuel say to him? I'll tell you who you are. You're the king. And this is not a time to be katon be'enecha. And therefore, may I dare suggest that that's what the Gemara said. Rachel exhibited an exemplary characteristic that we can call tzniut. She's willing to sacrifice for the sake of others. And that is indeed a tremendously admirable thing. But it was a little bit misplaced. Or a little bit excessive. And it led her to do something. There was a time that she shouldn't have sacrificed. It's a time that she should have said, I'm the one who's going to marry Yaakov. It would have been better for everybody. And therefore, what was she rewarded with? She's rewarded with a great-great-grandson who's exceedingly humble. And again, a great tzaddik who accomplished a lot, but who was ultimately brought down by his excessive humility. Yes?
But that's where I have a question, because you could see the opposite in what Rachel did. That is, that she manipulated the whole situation. She took it upon herself to give the siman in. So she was saying, I know better. I know what's good for Yaakov. I know what's good for Leah. You know, I'm going to direct, I'll be the play director from what we, on the side of the stage and,
okay,
and tell people what to do.
Similar to Shaul later on, who said, listen, the people think this is a good idea. Okay. All right, so maybe, I mean, that's interesting because what you're saying is excessive humility can lead to arrogance.
In a
sense,
yes,
right? All of a sudden,
yes,
you think you know what's, you know, yes, better than God, so to speak.
Which is what happened with Shaul later.
Right, that's what she's saying, right. Oh, exactly. Right.
It's okay.
So the question is, how does this go to Esther? So I thought about that. I don't have enough time to go into it. I'm not sure that I want to blame Esther with the same, although I thought about whether we can. But even if not, even if we want to, I thought of another way. Maybe we can, I want to get to one other point. So I'll leave open two possibilities for further thought. One could try to see if we can find within Esther also some kind of a misplaced, excessive whatever. But let's not do that for a moment. Let's grant that Esther, after all, Esther was in a very different situation. She was in a situation where she had no control over anything, and ultimately seized control, as perhaps Rachel did, but didn't wind up messing things up, wound up saving the people, and it's hard to blame her for all of that. But yeah? That's what I want to drive at. Right. In other words, let's start with this. Esther is a tragic. I mean, she's queen. Right? When we were little in Gan, you know, it's all beautiful. Wow, she becomes queen. But when one gets a little older and understands the life that Esther had to lead. And by the way, when one goes through the next Gemara in Megillah here, which is not on the page, which is separate, and discusses various possibilities of what type of life Esther had in the palace and whatever, it raises all kinds of... She certainly was in a very, very bad situation, had a tragic life. Not something that we would... In the end, she saved Am Yisrael, and we're eternally grateful, and we celebrate and read a book of Tanakh named for her every single year. You know, it's not exactly an unbridled, you know, nobody would want that to be, you know, your daughter, granddaughter. That's you know. So perhaps I'm suggesting that perhaps the reward for Shaul is also mixed, and perhaps it's also the tikkun, though. I was playing with the idea that we can, you know. That Am Yisrael, who got themselves into a big mess at that point of lack of tzniut or whatever, it's the tzniut from Shaul that eventually is redeemed, so to speak, by Esther or something along those lines. Yeah?
She does hesitate
when true, but then she turns it around. And that's another shear. If you look... I'll just throw something out here. I've given a whole shiur on this also. I think I may have given this shiur also. But if you look, up until then, the word vayitzav, or some form of it, is always used in relation to Esther, and she's completely passive. She does whatever she's told, whatever Mordechai tells her to do, whatever Hegai Sri Sanashin tells her to do, vati lakach Esther, she's taken, she's completely passive, she's very, very obedient. I have a whole theory that it could be that that's really why Ahasuerus wanted her also. After his last wife, he needs someone who's obedient. And Mordechai puts her in a situation where he's commanding her to do something that's completely against her nature, to go into the king and break all the rules. And she's like, you can't do it. And he puts her on that spot with that very dramatic pasuk, which in my mind is the turning point of everything. Right? And she does a complete switch. And all of a sudden it says that she commanded Mordechai. And he did kechol asher tzivta alav Esther. All of a sudden, she starts giving orders, and she does a complete—you know—that's the heroic act. And it's for that that I don't want to blame Esther. I think she's a real heroine there. That's what I'm saying. Yeah, right, exactly. Okay. But in any case, I think there's this possible link, you know, between Esther and Shaul in that sense. Between Rachel and Shaul in that sense. And I'm suggesting, tentatively and somewhat with trepidation, that perhaps that's really what the message of this Gemara. That it's not praising Rachel, it's praising her. It's not praising her in an unqualified way, but actually in a qualified way. It's saying that she exhibited a quality that was very, very admirable, but that was somewhat misplaced, and therefore her reward was someone who exhibited the same quality in a way that was very, very admirable, but somewhat misplaced, and he was rewarded, and then we have to figure out how to put Esther into that. With that, and with the 5 minutes I have, I just want to extrapolate from that. To the more contemporary discussion of the term tzniut. Because it is a buzzword in today's society, and it's a value that the idea that there are people that are emphatically advocating for this value and making great sacrifices for it, but perhaps at times in a manner that's misplaced or that has the wrong result, I think can resonate very, very much in today's Jewish world, and particularly here in Israel with some of the events over the last number of years. And if I'm right about the meaning of the Gemara, then the Gemara then takes on particular relevance. Every generation has its challenges. And one of the challenges of our generation today, I believe, is tzniut. I don't think it's coincidental that you find so much talk about this today. And anyone who's tried to give a shiur, as someone who taught young women, you know, teenage girls, it's a topic that comes up from time to time. They like to talk about it, or they don't like to talk about it. They like to get upset about it. They need to talk about it, whatever. It's a topic that I've had many occasion over the years in Chinuch to deal with. And when you go back, if you try to prepare a shiur about tzniut, and you go back and you try to find sources, you don't find that much discussion about it. not about the halakhic matters that concern young women today, about exactly how long their sleeves and their skirts and all that stuff have to be. There is material in halakha. It's not all made up, but it's sparsely discussed until fairly recently. It doesn't seem to be a topic that generated... The material's there, but it didn't generate much discussion until maybe the last few decades. If you look at the halakhic literature on the topic, what?
Because society...
Okay, exactly. Exactly. That's exactly the point I'm getting to. And even the value of tzniut, I originally came across some of these sources when I was looking for stuff about tzniut, and I had to go to a Gemara in Shabbos about Shatnez to find something. It's not a value that's discussed all that often. And the Gemara, and, you know, these sources here. But it's not and that's because, you know, there were times in history where Jews struggled about other things that seemed to us strange. Does it seem today reasonable that there was a time that people were excommunicated and that books were burnt because people were, and that Jews were fighting with one another bitterly about whether or not it was appropriate to study Aristotelian philosophy? Is anybody today really interested in studying Aristotelian philosophy? Is that the thing that you would, right? Once upon a time, Jews fought to the death over the fact that they insisted on worshiping pagan idols. Does that make any sense to us today? Does anybody have any desire to go out and worship pagan idols? At different points in history, right? We are influenced by the societies around us, and different things become the challenge. And there's no question in my mind that one of, not the only, but one of the main challenges that we have today is this issue of tzniut in all of its ramifications, both the narrow and the broad. Because today we live in a society. We're not really interested today so much in worshiping pagan gods, because even the non-Jews around us don't worship pagan gods in most cases. Maybe those of us, you know, who live in certain far-flung corners of the world see it, and maybe, I don't know, maybe in those countries it's more of an issue, I don't know. Right? But the messages of monotheism that our ancestors fought for and died for in many cases, the world has heard, more or less. And therefore it's less of an issue for us now. And many of these other battles have been fought through. But for better and for worse, we live in a world which has absorbed many of the Torah's values, and which therefore, in my opinion, I'm not one of those who comes along and says, you know, we have to withdraw from society. I think we Jews have much to gain from interactions with the non-Jewish world, those of us who live abroad, with our neighbors, and those of us here in Israel, with the world and the international community in general. I think we have much to learn from modern society. I don't think we have all the answers. But one of the issues on which modern society, it seems, is really struggling and seems to be completely off the mark, and which the Torah's message is not easily heard nowadays, is this issue of tzniut in all of its ramifications, both in terms of the very idea that a person should not be concerned with himself or herself, but with higher ideals, that a person should sacrifice what's good, their own self-fulfillment, for the sake of others or for the sake of higher ideals. Those don't resonate very much in modern society. The idea that a person that there is something higher than one's own pleasure and success and fulfillment, and certainly anything that remotely approaches the Torah's view of morality on sexual matters and on dress in particular, is just completely, completely out of whack with the society in which we live. And therefore, that's the issue, or one of the issues that we struggle with nowadays. How do we deal with those struggles? So certainly, without defining who I'm talking about, because to a large extent this is what the debate is about, but there definitely are elements among us who deal with it by giving in, or by adopting values that don't really work with the rest of the Torah. And again, you know, there was a time, and maybe you saw this on your Tehillim with Shuli, I don't know, but you can go to any archaeological museum, for example, and see things that tell us seem completely incongruous. You can see Jews who worshipped God who also kept little pagan figurines in there. And in every archaeological site from the First Temple period, we find these, including here in Yerushalayim, in the shadow of the Beit HaMikdash. Jews had little pagan gods, and to us that seems completely incongruous. And there are Jews today who observe many aspects of the Torah, and when it comes to things that touch on the topic of tzniut, so that they don't observe. And then there are those who notice that and try to respond by emphasizing a value that in the society at large is not emphasized. The problem is that you, in doing that, run the risk of falling into the pattern of Rachel and Shaul, whose tzniut became excessive to the point that perhaps it misses the mark and even backfires. In my opinion, what's needed is acknowledgement that this is a serious challenge, and to try to find the right balance. But to the extent that the reading the Gemara that we tentatively suggested here is accurate, then that may be the message of this Gemara that maybe was missed in earlier generations. Right? It's the wisdom of Chazal, perhaps, to put it there for it to kind of reverberate now, where the Gemara that's praising Rachel and Shaul for their tzniut might also be warning about making sure that it's balanced with other things and it doesn't cause unintended consequences. So I think that's part of what we need to contemplate when we think about Rachel's legacy. Thank you very much.
Thank you.